How do you think Polos is doing?
As a central banker? You know, I think he's doing,
no,
a good job.
No, as a human being. Like, is he a good father? No, I'm kidding. Yeah, of course, as a central banker.
Welcome to the Mostly Money, Mostly Canadian podcast with your host, Preet Banerjee.
Welcome back to Mostly Money. I'm your host, Preet Banerjee, and on the show today, the most requested guest on the podcast is back. Ben Rabideau, an expert in Canadian housing and credit trends, checks in again to explain what's been happening on the real estate front in Canada in the last little while and why you should take out the biggest HELOC you can so you can buy Bitcoin futures. Okay, that part was a joke. As usual, before we get to the interview, thank you again to the listeners who have left star ratings on iTunes, and a special thanks to those who have left reviews. Alpha Gob, who says the podcast is better than a shorthanded goal in overtime. Clearly a true Canuck. BMKJP, who wants me to get Michael Katchen back on the show. He's the CEO of Wealthsimple, for an update on how things have progressed since the last time he was on. So I will reach out to him in 2018 and see if he's willing to come back on. He's kind of a big deal now, so I don't know if he'll give me the time, but it's worth a shot, I guess. Incognito 50, and also Sean Richards, who started listening about 3 or 4 months ago. And hopefully, Sean, you are still listening, because I haven't podcasted in a while, as per usual. Now, if you haven't done so yet, I really do appreciate you taking 5 seconds to leave a rating on iTunes. And if you want to take the additional time to write in a comment on top of that, I do read them all. And now, without further ado, let's get to today's guest. Joining me now is Ben Rabideau, no stranger to this podcast. This is now the third time I think you've been on the podcast between the two versions of the podcast. I don't know if you remember, but the first version I think was called something really stupid, like the Where Does All My Money Go Internet Radio Show or something like that.
I do remember.
Well ahead of its time. And then, of course, you've joined. Actually, I think this is your fourth time.
No, I think it's third.
Is it?
I think. I only remember. Well, maybe we had too much to drink one of those times.
Yeah. Now, speaking of, or I guess I should introduce you, although you're not really a stranger to the podcast, but just very briefly, why don't you tell people what it is that you do, and then we'll get into my various questions that I have on all things credit and real estate related.
Sure. I run Northco Advisors, which is a research firm where we track primarily Canadian macroeconomic trends with emphasis on household credit and housing broadly. Clients would tend to be institutional investors, Canada, US, and abroad. And we tend to kind of try to have a view on housing rates, currency, and just the general direction of the broad economy.
Excellent. And you emailed me out of the blue and said you really enjoyed the podcast with Scott Terrio, which was actually your push.
Yeah, he's great.
Because I always had him on my radar. And then you said, hey, you should have Scott on. And so I reached out to Scott and he was on, and we ended up talking for like an hour and 45 minutes. And people are saying, yeah, it could have been longer. Which is strange. You wouldn't expect that. Now, the other thing that listeners always say is you've got to get Ben Rabideau back on. Everyone absolutely loves every time you come on the podcast. So cheers. Thank you very much for coming.
My pleasure.
I've got lots of questions for you. There's a lot of things changing, that we want to talk about in terms of real estate, housing, and credit. But before we do that, I thought I'd start by just following up on the last podcast with Scott. Because Scott was kind enough to actually not only drink with me on the podcast, as you are doing now, but he also brought a bottle of scotch. No pressure. great guest. Brought a bottle of scotch. Ben showed up empty-handed.
Hey, that's offered to buy you dinner.
That's true. That is true. But we are drinking the bottle that Scott brought. So this is Glenmorangie Quinta Rubin. And it is absolutely delicious. So I know you're not, you're more of a beer guy.
Yeah, I'm not a huge heavyweight on the scotch, but I'm enjoying this.
Yeah. No, it's fantastic. So for the few, people who tune into the podcast for just hearing about the whiskey, let me just sort of explain what we're drinking here. So Glenmorangie is a distillery in Scotland, and they have their sort of famous, their 10-year original. Now their 10-year original actually takes quote unquote 20 years to make. Here's how that works. So what they do is when they distill the spirit, they put it into a cask for 10 years. They take that cask, so that was a first fill cask, and then they refill it. So now it becomes a second fill cask, and they distill a new spirit for another 10 years. So technically, yes, it's a 10-year, but the first batch took really 20 years to make, if you think of it that way, because they mix, I think in 50-50 proportion, the first cask fill and the second fill cask together, and then you get the 10-year original. Then what they'll do sometimes is they'll take that 10-year original, they'll make these different bottles. And this is one of those bottles. So they finish that 10-year original in port casks. So depending on what the casks were originally used to sort of age can sort of change the flavor. So what we're drinking is a beautiful color. You can't see on the podcast, but it is a gorgeous colored scotch. So it's the 10-year Glenmorangie finished for another 2 years in this port cask, and it's absolutely delicious.
It's very good.
Anyways, we can follow that with beer if you like. So anyways, cheers to Scott. Thank you for bringing the bottle.
Yeah, let me say something about Scott. That's you probably don't know this, but I when I have some of my institutional clients in Toronto, so these might be, you know, big pension funds or hedge funds or whatever. They love talking to Scott. He's one of the most articulate people in the space.
Yeah,
and I think the point that he made in that recent McLean's article is so underappreciated in Canada, which is just that internationally there's this view, and even here in Canada as well, there's this view that mortgage debt follows you forever,
right?
Even post bankruptcy, right? Which is really not true. And I don't know if Scott got into some of the nitty gritty of it, but you know, in Canada, there's a scenario where someone, if you end up with a $500,000 shortfall on a mortgage and you're unemployed, you can declare bankruptcy. And if there's no surplus income, 9 months later, it's fully discharged, $1,500 admin fee.
Yeah, you walk away.
Like, I'm telling you, nobody knows that. Yeah. Nobody.
Yeah, right? And you're right. Yes, we did talk about that on the podcast specifically, about this idea about jingle mail. And how people thought, well, maybe in Alberta it happens occasionally, but everywhere else, no, it's totally different. That's right. Why it's different in Canada. It turns out, no, actually it's not.
Well, and what's interesting is if you look internationally, you look at countries like Spain or Ireland. Ireland's a great example. Ireland has much more stringent recourse laws than we do.
Right.
And you look at what happened in their financial crisis, right? It just doesn't matter. I mean, the empirical data on this front's quite clear that you can't squeeze blood from a stone.
Right.
Right. And the US is a great example because there's a number of US states that are recourse and the non-recourse states. Mm-hmm. And the delinquency rate, the difference between recourse and non-recourse states it's negligible. Right. So it doesn't matter. It's a secondary factor when you get into a really stressed economic climate, which thankfully we haven't had in Canada. But for the people who are saying, well, it's different here, we can never have a housing downturn because of recourse, that's just the wrong way to think about it. You know, there's valid arguments why we might not have a major real estate downturn, but that's just not one of them.
put it simple. So basically what you're saying here on the record is that there's going to be a major market meltdown starting
next
week.
That's not this guy. That's, oh, yeah. Well, in Bitcoin, maybe. Right?
Yeah. Oh, God. Don't get me started on Bitcoin. I think I talked about this with Scott, too, but everywhere you go, people are talking about Bitcoin.
It's amazing.
And our only advice to anyone listening out there is get HELOC as big as you can and put all of it into Bitcoin.
No. Bitcoin futures.
Bitcoin futures.
Leverage on leverage is the way you make money. I read that in a book once.
Just to be clear to everyone who's listening, do not do that. Do not do that. We are totally joking. Okay, so let's get into some topical items of credit in real estate and what's going on. And it is really still a national pastime for a lot of people is talking about housing. So let's start with this idea. You mentioned to me offline that Canadian consumers will finally hit the bricks. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so we are in a period here in Canada where household spending has driven a disproportionate share of GDP growth.
Right.
And we saw it even last quarter. Big beat in household final consumption expenditures. Now, when you start to look at the sort of inputs that drive consumer spending, part of it is confidence based, and then part of it's kind of access to credit, and then part is like organic income growth. Mm-hmm. So, if you look at those three components, you could make the case that 2018 is going to be a challenging environment for consumers in Canada because we've got new regulatory changes coming down the pipeline.
Yeah, we'll get into
B20.
That.
Yeah, we'll look at that in more detail. But I would say there's kind of three things to consider. One is that you've got a slowdown in house price appreciation.
Right.
So, you know, still positive nationally, but down from the peaks. So if you look at how much the average homeowner can pull out of their house in terms of equity, it's down sharply from what it was even last year at this time. And that's it's a big amount. If we look nationally, it's almost $50 billion a year is withdrawn from housing equity. In a $2 trillion economy, that's a big deal.
Right.
Right. And so, you know, part of that goes to fund consumption directly. So some people literally pull off a HELOC to, you know, fund a vacation or buy a boat or whatever. But I think more importantly, what it does for more people is it allows room to consolidate higher interest debt and provide more cash flow.
Right.
Right. And so one of the things we hear often, I mean, Scott would have told you some horror stories, but people who run up credit card debt, roll it into their mortgage, right? Rinse, repeat, a couple years later, they're back.
Yep.
And I'll just tell you that dynamic of slowing price appreciation and these new B20 rules, which are going to force borrowers to stress test. If they want to refinance, they have to stress test against a much higher rate. It is going to be like hitting a wall for refis.
Right. Because really what's happened in the last little while is that people who have been spending beyond their means and racking up these debts on their credit cards, because house prices have been appreciating so much and credit is relatively loose, they can just sort of get away with that. And that behavior will continue because the system has allowed them to do that.
Yeah. I mean, Scott's the perfect guy to talk to about that, because he sees that. I mean, he'd tell you, they see people that should have filed years ago and yet they're able to go out and get another unsecured line or roll their debt into housing equity.
And yeah. And so a point I kind of want to ask you about here. So yeah, certainly when I was talking to Scott, we're talking about people who see him or on the verge of seeing him or should be seeing him. Those are people who are right at the end of their rope. But this also occurs with people who, you know, make good money. They may not be close to bankruptcy, but it's still bad behavior, right? It's not prudent personal financial behavior to do this, and they've gotten away with it. And they may not get caught out if there is a downturn. They might get, you know, a bit of a squeeze, but they may not claim bankruptcy. But that's not necessarily a great thing, because it's going to put the brakes on consumer spending, because they're not going to say, oh, you know what, I'm going to be smarter with how I manage my money. It's because now they can't. Right, they can't continue doing that because they no longer have access to the credit, which has been because of these variables that we talked about.
Right. So I would say that the people who are in that kind of higher income bracket, and when you talk to insolvency trustees, that's one of the striking trends that you hear, is that 10 years ago, the people coming into their office and filing insolvencies, generally it's like a life situation, life circumstance that happened.
Yeah,
or it's sort of the people that are just massively over indebted and, you know, lower paying and just, you know, expenses just couldn't keep up with the income, sort of thing, or vice versa, I guess. And now they're seeing a lot more, as to your point, just a lot more kind of dual income, good jobs, but just a ton of debt. Now, those people might be all right, because, you know, the B20 rules are really going to pinch the people who are at the high end of the debt service ratio spectrum.
Right.
Which tend to be, I mean, for those people that are kind of professional dual income or whatever, you gotta have a lot of unsecured debt before that really starts to matter. But, you know, at the end of the day, on aggregate, like in aggregate, when you look at what it's going to mean, it's just going to mean less credit, less home equity withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be a big change. The other thing that we didn't talk about is just that we're into a different regime with rates.
Yeah.
And I know it's a big topic you want to discuss, but I guess just briefly, I submitted a chart from McLean's. They do this annual, you know, charts to watch. And did you put one in for that?
They asked me to. I was so busy, I couldn't get to it. Yeah, I really wanted to. But
well, you should have done one on Bitcoin. That would have been good. So I put one in, and it was just looking at the change in monthly mortgage payments per $100,000 borrowed at first renewal, which I know is a lot. But the point there is just, if you take out a mortgage for $100,000, 5 years later at renewal, what's going to happen to your monthly payment? And we know that rates have generally been going down for almost 30 years.
Right.
Right. And so you see that, like, every on a rolling basis, people who borrowed 5 years ago, when it comes up for renewal, their payments drop. For 25 years, that's been the trend.
Mm-hmm.
And then starting this summer, we saw that it finally flipped. So rates have been so low for so long, and then you had this little bit of an uptick. And all of a sudden, that puts people who borrowed 5 years ago who are coming back for renewal, all of a sudden, they're renewing at a higher interest rate. And that's a very new dynamic. And I think, you know, when you get into something that could pressure consumer spending broadly. That's a big one. And it's not like a small deal, right? I mean, we're talking about consumer spending being over 70% of real GDP growth over the last 5 years. It's been a big driver.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right that we need to sort of take a real close look on this, because if there's an increase in rates, and even if it is a moderate, slow, progressive increase, we're still switching from an environment where people, again, they were given more rope with which to sort of hang themselves with. And now that tide is changing. And an increase of 50, 100 bucks, 200 bucks per month, that's a big deal.
Absolutely.
Right? Because that, again, it's the reversal here that's really important. So, so with that being the case, and the consumer spending being such an important part of the economy, is it possible that you see a scenario where there's no collapse in housing, but there's a real stagnation for the economy? Maybe that tips the economy into a recession, which then leads to a housing market downturn. What if you had a crystal ball? You know, what do you think is on the horizon?
Sure. Here? Well, you know how well my crystal ball works, so I'll caveat yes. that. So, look, I would say with the whole consumer spending thing, I think it's one of my highest conviction views that we're going to see quite weak consumer spending. Mm-hmm. Now, I'll say that. I think we're also going to see very strong wage growth in the first half of the year, which I know would sort of seem to argue against this thesis. But
due to what?
Well, if you look at, so I know you've got the data in front of you. So for the listeners, Preet's got my latest note for my clients, which is just kind of 2018 outlook and some of the key themes that our team's watching. And one of them is this idea that the Bank of Canada is probably going to hike in Q1, but that when we get to the back half of the year, they're going to probably end up quite dovish. Now, one of the reasons I think they're going to hike, and one of the reasons I think wage growth is going to come in fairly hot, is if you look at, so there's two things. One is if you look at the number of job vacancies right now, it's at a record high. So a record number of firms are reporting an inability to hire staff. Okay. Now, along the same lines, those same surveys where they look at the percentage of firms that cite a shortage of skilled and unskilled labor, it's at an all-time high as a share of all firms. Mm-hmm. So those trends, usually you see that just in advance of a sharp uptick in wages. And so I think that's coming. I think that people will generally be surprised at the strength of wage growth in the first half of 2018. Now, that would seem, you know, when you hear that and you hear somebody saying, well, I think consumer spending is going to be weak, that doesn't seem to reconcile. The issue is if the Bank of Canada moves again, and the market right now is kind of pricing in just a little over two hikes, and I think that's probably the right way to think about it, then it negates it, right? It ends up being, if you look at it from a discretionary income perspective, it there's no net gain.
Right.
Right. Now, what I would say is, if the Bank of Canada sits on the sidelines, so if something goes really sideways with NAFTA, or if, you know, Trump drops a nuke on North Korea, or God knows what, and the Bank of Canada goes, all right, we're going to sit on the sidelines for a while, and we still get that strong income growth,
right?
Then, you know, then you walk back your expectations for that weak consumption, right? It's a bit of a moderating factor. But even if we have that strong wage growth, you still have this effect of a major tightening from OSFI,
right,
which is going to limit credit availability. And so I still think it could end up being a pretty challenging environment for those retailers.
Okay, let me pause you for a second. Mm-hmm. So for our newer listeners, perhaps, let's break down some terminology just so we're not leaving anyone behind with jargon. So you mentioned, I think, dovish in the second half of the year. You want to explain just very quickly the difference between hawkish and dovish when we talk about central banking?
Sure. So the idea there is dovish would imply a kind of loosening bias, which means that they'd be more prone to either leave rates the same or cut them.
Right.
And a hawkish perspective would mean they're more inclined to raise rates.
Right.
And so right now, the bank is trying to convince the markets that they're neutral on their outlook and on their bias. But I think everybody reads through that and sees that there's a hawkish bias here right now. Mm-hmm. They're prone to tighten. They want to tighten, which means they want to raise rates.
Right.
But if we end up with a scenario where the economy is a little weaker in the back half as a result of a consumer slowdown and maybe some weakness in the housing sector, it's going to put the bank on hold, right? Especially if you get any weakness in NAFTA.
Right. Now, and one of the things that the Bank of Canada is always talking about is that they're always worried about the level of indebtedness of Canadian households. And if they don't watch themselves and rates go up and that causes problems, then doesn't that kind of handcuff the central bank in terms of what they can do? Like if they wanted to raise rates and at the same time raising rates is what would cause a downturn, I guess that's the challenge, but what is the Bank of Canada? Do you have any insight into how they would handle that? Like, do they consider the household or what are they looking at?
They absolutely consider the household. So if you read any of the monetary policy reports, they emphasize tremendously where the risks are.
Yeah.
And that's their job as a central bank is now their main mandate is to control inflation.
Yeah.
Right. But inflation often can be a function of, well, we won't get into that. It's too much. For this conversation, it's probably a little too deep for,
right.
But let's just say that that factoring into inflation is all sorts of other inputs such as demographics and possible debt deleveraging dynamics and so they consider all of those and as well as any kind of exogenous shock to the economy. And so one of the things they've pointed out and have been very clear on is that the economy is much more sensitive to interest rate increases than it was in the past.
Right.
Which is code for the central banks to mean they're going to proceed very cautiously.
Right.
Right. And it was funny, like on the last monetary policy report, during the scrum, you know, the reporter scrum, they're kind of asking, well, what do you mean by cautiously? And the letter is like, well, it means what it means in the dictionary. It's that we're going to be cautious, right? Because people are always, it's funny, like people who watch central banks are always like trying to, you know, parse the words.
And, oh, like, yeah, they do like a differential out, analysis, like,
yeah,
word
yeah,
for word.
Yeah, it's incredible, right? And I think some of these central bankers like Polaz, they're kind of just, you know, sick of that. And they're like, well, no, it literally just means we're going to be cautious, right? Which means we're going to, you know, we're going to hike and then we're going to wait and see what happens. Yeah. And then we might hike. And so I think that's how they're thinking about it. But it's going to be a balancing act, right? And you know, when I was on the podcast last time, I said, I think mortgage rates have probably bottomed,
right?
But I wouldn't be surprised if the Bank of Canada cut again.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, half right. Here we are. The bank
has
cut
twice since then, I think, since you were on last.
Okay. We'll go with that. We'll go. Thanks, buddy.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're totally right, man.
Thanks, man. But you know what? It's, I think we're at a point now where the data is very clear that the economy is running quite hot. There's
what's
really
the reason
no
for that? I know there's a lot of government spending, right? Is that part of it? Is it also the household?
There's a lot of consumer spending.
Yeah. I mean,
if you look at the big beats from the last couple of quarters that have really driven sentiment and really driven markets to price in a tightening bias, it's been these big GDP prints from the last couple of quarters. And by and large, it's been a consumer spending story.
And before I ask you about B20 and explain what the B20 rules are that you've mentioned a couple of times, how do you think Polaz is doing?
As a central banker, you know, I think he's doing
a
good job.
No, as a human being, like, is he a good father? No, I'm kidding. Yeah, of course, as a central banker.
You know, I think he's got a challenging job. I think it's, it's a situation where if we go back a year and a half ago, you had an economy where in Ontario, it was humming, and in BC, it was humming. But in the resource regions, it was a real disaster.
Right.
So how do you, as a central banker, how do you manage all that?
Yeah.
Right? It's not an easy task, right? And so now he's trying to get to a point where we've got a bit more synchronized growth. I think things in Alberta, I know most forecasts have, you know, really strong GDP growth, in some cases 4% for next year. I think that's really high.
Mm-hmm.
And I still see a lot of issues they have to work through in Alberta that are more structural in nature. But all that to say, we've got more synchronized growth and he's at the point now where he's got to kind of embark on this tightening. So I think given the hand he was dealt, he's playing it well.
All right. So now let's go to B20. So you mentioned this a couple times. I think, I don't know if we mentioned it or not on the podcast with Scott, but let's walk through what do you mean when you mention the word the B20 regulations?
Sure. So OSFI, which is the Office of the Superintendent of Financial Institutions, so they are the regulator for any federally regulated deposit-taking institution. So
right.
Think of the big banks. It's the easiest way to think about that. And they set policy that governs how the bank should lend
right.
across various credit products, and with a lot of emphasis on consumer products, so mortgages, HELOCs, home equity lines of credit, et cetera. Now, one of the things that we saw, if you go back to 2016, the feds brought in some rules that tightened the mortgage underwriting for insured mortgages.
Right.
So you have to get the stress test.
Yes.
And what it created was this incentive for people to get to 20% down so they could bypass the stress test and get an uninsured mortgage.
And the stress test was?
Well, it meant that you had to qualify at a much higher interest rate. So even though your contract interest rate might be, just to use a round number, it might be 3%.
Yep.
They said, we want to make sure that there's enough wiggle room in your budget that you can absorb higher rates. And so we'll for the purpose of qualifying you, we'll use 5% and test your debt service ratios against that 5%. Now that only applied to insured mortgages.
Right.
So you can see
20% down or less. Or less than 20% down.
Less than 20% down, and you need insurance. And so it created this strange system where as soon as you got to 20% down, you got 40% more mortgage.
Right.
And so at the time, you could kind of, I mean, it's funny, back in October 2016 when this was announced, I put out a note to clients saying, you know, on the surface is a big deal. Here are the ways that this could be circumvented. And
did that include borrowing money so that you have a bigger down payment?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that was one of the things we highlighted is you're going to see a big surge in what we call co-lending.
Yeah.
Where you have a bank lend up to 80% and then some sort of, you know, private lender, whatever, come in, top it up to 90%. And as soon as you do that, you end up with, you bypass the insurance requirements, you get a much bigger mortgage. So we flagged all of these for our clients, but I had no idea the extent to which that loophole would be exploited. And to frame it for you, if you look at the latest data from OSFI, which is, so they have monthly balance sheet filings from the big banks, what you find is the insured mortgages on banks' balance sheets are declining at a 5% year-over-year clip. They're
really?
Actually declining.
Really?
Never happened before.
Wow. Right?
And the uninsured mortgages are growing 18% year-over-year.
Okay, so the B20 changes basically say that stress test, which originally was just for the insured mortgages with down payments of less than 20%, now applies to all mortgages.
All mortgages granted by federally regulated entities.
Right, yes.
Correct.
Important distinction.
It is in theory. So there's a lot less wiggle room, a lot less loopholes available there. Some people have pointed out that you could go to a non-federally regulated entity like a credit union. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's going to be a huge workaround for a few reasons. One, they're somewhat capital constrained. They can't absorb that much volume.
Right.
But then also I think the provincial regulators may come on board as well and kind of lean on them.
Okay.
But I'll tell you, you will see a big boom in private lending, which I know is a topic you may want to get to at some point. So I think they'll be the big winners in all of this. But it's going to be insufficient to offset this credit tightening. It's just there's no easy workaround to this rule. So I think it'll be it's going to be a real headwind for the housing market at a time where, frankly, in Toronto, as we know, there's some real problems, especially when you get it in the 905.
So would it be fair to say that the era of loose and cheap credit is starting to come to an end?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So now you mentioned private lending. So what is private lending in a nutshell?
Sure. So this is a form of lending that's gaining a lot of popularity in Canada. It's seeing some pretty massive growth, still relatively small as an overall share, but seeing huge growth. And right. So what this is it takes several forms, but it's a loan from a much less regulated entity. And that could be literally could be an individual. Mm-hmm. So I could literally lend to you. I go on title. I'm your borrower. I'm your bank. Right. And my name is actually on title as a mortgagee. And that's one form. And then it can also happen more through what we call mortgage investment corporations, which mm-hmm. tend to raise capital from investors. And then they lend to these kind of credit impaired individuals that kind of fall outside of the traditional banking space.
So I could be a guy who has a bunch of GICs. I'm like, man, these interest rates I'm getting are pathetic. I want to find a little bit more juice. So I will seek out maybe someone who runs a mortgage investment corporation, say, here's all the money I had in my GICs. Get me a better rate. That mortgage investment corporation turns around and finds people who have trouble borrowing money from, say, a big five bank and gets them a higher interest rate on their mortgage and presumably a higher rate of default. So there's higher risk, higher return.
Okay. Yep, absolutely. And then so that's right. And then you would pocket that difference. So yeah, the rates are pretty steep in some cases. I mean, if you're looking at a first mortgage from a private lender, it can be anywhere from at the very low end, 6%, mm-hmm. Typically plus fees. And the fees on these are often 2 or 3%.
Really?
That's amazing. So this is the issue with private lending. And one of the real concerns I've had for a long time is There's the rate, which is steep enough, but they're interest only.
Right.
So a 10% mortgage, you're only paying the interest on, there's no amortization, which is part of their popularity.
Right.
But then embedded behind that 10% interest rate is all sorts of additional fees. And they can run, I mean, it's not uncommon to see 10% interest rate and then another 4 or 5% in fees embedded within.
Really?
And they're all 1 year mortgages.
Right. Right.
So the effective rate ends up being like often 15% or north of that.
So are they all interest only, or are some of them principal and interest?
Overwhelmingly interest only.
Okay.
Yeah. That's right. It just makes it easier for the accounting.
Now, is there a bit of a risk if they're all for short terms, like a year or whatever, the people that take out these private mortgages, let's say there's some kind of event and everyone says, all right, that's it, we're pulling our hands off the table here. How do these people refinance? Like, and what risk does that create?
Well, you know my answer on this. So this has been an issue of mine for a while. This has been a real concern of mine. So anytime you have a situation where you have very short duration mortgages, so in this case, 1 year.
Yeah.
And the funding structure behind that is very flighty capital.
Yeah.
So in other words, the situation you described with the GIC investor looking for higher yield, perfect analogy. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the people that are funding these mortgages tend to be kind of mom and pop investors just looking for a bit more yield.
Right.
And often of the view that this is very low risk yield, which is, you and I both know that risk and reward.
Yeah. Can't get around that.
Right. So these are by nature, these are higher risk loans. Now, they've performed exceptionally well because you've been in a strong upwards market with a very strong economy behind it. So really no one's defaulting.
Right.
But to your point, the concern would be, okay, so you've got this pool of capital financing these 1 year loans. What happens if the investors behind those are like, all right, you know, I think I'd like my money back now. And maybe I'll move over here. I see a better investment opportunity or whatever. Then that pool of capital actually shrinks, and it means that some people won't be able to renew those mortgages. So if you follow through what that actually looks like, it means that the lender, the private mortgage lender, will go power of sale. They'll actually, if you can't find another lender to finance them out, they'll come in and they'll actually take your house and sell it.
Right.
Right. So it introduces a lot of risk in the market. It's a highly unstable and very opaque part of the market. And, you know, I think it's one that regulators are going to increasingly be looking at.
Okay. Let's switch gears a little bit. Before I get to that, I don't want to switch gears. Let's talk about mortgage fraud. And the reason I bring this up is I've seen a number of headlines in various newspapers that have talked about, it looks like some people are lying about how much money they earn, and there's not been the verification that you would normally expect in a handful of cases. Do you think that this is maybe a bit more rampant than the average person might suspect?
I do. I've been saying this for a few years. I mean, if you go back to, I think it was 2014, I wrote an op-ed in the Globe and Mail. This is way before the whole home capital thing blew up earlier this year.
Right, yeah.
Earlier this year. It was disclosed in 2015, yeah. But it blew up this year.
Yeah.
And it was before the whole Laurentian thing came out just a couple of weeks ago. And I was saying at the time, if you look at the way that mortgages are set up in Canada, it's a funny system where you have the banks are able to pass the risk on to the insurers,
mm-hmm.
right? So as long as the loan is being insured, they bear no risk, which is a strange scenario. And it's one that I've often argued, like, it's hard to find an insurance scheme anywhere where you don't pay a deductible.
Right.
Because the whole concept is there, you need some skin in the game.
Yeah.
Right. So you shouldn't be able to just trash your car and drive like an idiot and the insurer just covers it and there's no repercussions for you. The idea is they want to make sure that you have skin in the game.
Right.
Right. But we have this situation in Canada where the insurers take on all the risk. And so consequently, the lenders are able to, in some cases, turn a blind eye to some of this stuff.
Yeah. Cause what do they care?
Well, that's just it. So you've divorced the risk from the actual lending. And to me, that's a problem. So if all you know is that, the risk has been divorced from the lending. And if you know that the people originating the mortgages are volume compensated, and then if you further do some digging on the insurers themselves and see how they've handled previous. So for example, I mean, you haven't seen this, but I put a note out to my client. We got some documents from CMHC. Actually, it was through another researcher who had done a freedom of information search around how CMHC, which is the Crown Corporation, one of the big insurers, how they handled the whole home capital fraud fiasco. Mm-hmm. This will blow your mind. So in this freedom of information dump, we saw that somebody senior at Home Trust, which is a lending subsidiary, the trust company at Home Capital, notified CMHC, I think late 2014, that they had discovered fraud. Okay. And there's this like little kind of internal memo. Yeah, we thank them for coming forward, and that's kind of it. All right. And then so as any rational person kind of looking at this, you would think, all right, if I was an insurer, my first question would be, what's the size of the fraud? Are these brokers who are originating, are they sending it through any other lenders? Like, do we have potential exposure through other lenders anywhere? Like all these sort of questions, right? And should we be cutting them off? Like
simple, like, basic questions simple that basic any risk questions. Manager would look at.
You would think, right? Nothing. So at least not from anything we saw on the freedom of information dump that we got. You fast forward 7 or 8 months, it gets disclosed publicly from Home Capital. The media goes nuts. And then all of a sudden you see these frantic emails going around. Mm-hmm. Senior at CMHC going, maybe we should ask for the names of the people involved. Like, I'm not kidding you, man. That's literally, there's an email going, should we ask for the names of the people who are original? Like, this is 8 months later.
Right.
Right. And still they have no concept of the size of it. Right. And so then you got to fast forward. Like, it's hilarious. These documents, like, they're showing that, you know, almost a year after they were informed from Home Trust, they're still getting their information from like the Globe and Mail and like Mortgage Broker News. Like literally, you can't make this up. They're like, oh, hey, there's actual emails where there's like, oh, hey, did you see this article from Globe and Mail? It's kind of interesting. I'm not making this is unbelievable, right?
Yeah.
And then so there's even one, this is the best. There's one from somebody who's senior in credit adjudication to somebody senior at Home Trust. And it's like, hey man, can we get together for a coffee and discuss this? I just kind of want to like understand what went down. And like, to me reading this, I'm like, man, shouldn't this be more like, get your ass in my office, bring your lawyer, right? And we got to figure this out, right? Like, to me, that should be the relationship here. Like, you've transferred the risk from the lender onto the taxpayers, and you're so far behind the eight ball on this fraud disclosure.
Yeah.
So when you put all these pieces together, like, why wouldn't there be an issue with document fraud in Canada? Right. The lenders, I'll give you a crazy example. So a good friend of mine, who I won't name here, just because this is, you know, he's passed this long confidence, but I'm sure he's okay if I just kind of throw this story out there without his name attached to it. Mortgage broker in Ontario. And he had a deal, this is going back a few years ago, where he had three brothers come in, all fairly new immigrants, all self-employed. So I can't recall if they owned a store or some sort of business, but all self-employed. So clearly these are not the sort of borrowers that would fit into that kind of traditional insured box. They would be uninsured, kind of like a home capital type thing, right? And so that would mean that they would be paying slightly higher rates and they would have to make a larger down payment. So, you know, he explains this to them. He gets all the paperwork ready and prepares the file, sends it off. So he's got a lot of time sunk into this. And then they come back and say, we're going to go with a different broker. He's like, okay, well, that's kind of suspicious. So he does a bit of digging, finds out that they all bought these homes, all three of them, all with 95% financing. He's like, that's impossible because they wouldn't qualify for the insurance. So at this point, he's kind of pissed because he's invested a lot of time in this.
Sure.
And he knows that fraud has happened. And so he's able, through a bit of sleuthing, to figure out, you know, who the broker was and who the lender is. So he calls the business development manager at that lender and says, you guys have just originated a loan. It's fraudulent. I've got all the paperwork here that proves that this is a fraudulent.
Oh,
yeah. Because there's no way they should have qualified for insurance.
Oh, boy, yeah.
The bank, this is crazy. The bank goes, listen, man, that's an insured mortgage. We can't, you know, we're not going to reopen that.
Oh.
So he goes, okay, no problem. Calls the insurer and the insurer goes, well, we can't open a file unless there's a claim made against it, unless something goes delinquent.
What?
Yeah, no, I'm not making this up. So then he goes, he's kind of pissed at this point. He's like, well, all right, I'll call Fisco, which is the entity that regulates the mortgage, and I'll report this mortgage broker and maybe they'll get involved. Calls Fisco and Fisco's like, well, there's been no damages. We can't investigate. There's no one's been damaged.
Oh my God.
And so that's like this big circle where everybody's waiting for the other person to act.
Right. Right?
And you know, that's the regulatory apparatus. I hate to say it, but that's the regulatory apparatus in Canada. So, you know, given that, of course there's going to be fraud. Now, I can't speak to how pervasive it is, but I'll tell you it's more pervasive than the average listener would want to believe.
And there was a recent article in the Globe and Mail. They did an investigation on the regulatory environment of white-collar crime and whatnot.
You know my views on that.
Yeah. I would suggest to listeners you might want to check that out. Do you remember the names of the authors?
That one I don't, but it's true. It's a white collar crime in Canada. It really lacks.
Yeah.
I'll give you a great example just to back up to the whole mortgage fraud story. And I don't mean to throw Laurentian Bank under the bus by any means, but what the CEO said on BNN is super telling. And I'd invite your listeners to look up this interview with the CEO of Laurentian Bank on BNN. This would have been about 2 weeks ago. So call it, you know, early December. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so this is right after they disclosed that they had found some what they call irregularities, okay, yeah. Which is code in the industry for mortgage fraud, right? And what's amazing is he gets on BNN and he says, we found these irregularities. And I know it sounds really bad, but what it is it's actually where people, like they say that they make 70,000 or 60, but they really only make 60.
So an outright lie.
This is how he's framing. He's like, well, I know it sounds bad, but it's really just people like lying about their income.
No, that really is bad.
Right. I know. You and I understand that. And what's hilarious is in Canada, we have a term for that where we call it either soft fraud or we call it fraud for shelter. Do you know what they call it in any other country? Fraud. It's fraud, right? So this drives me nuts. Like, what the hell is soft fraud?
Right.
Right. But this is what we call it. It's like, well, it's, yeah, no one, yeah, we lied to get into our house, but really, we really like the house. We want to live there. So it's like a white lie.
Yeah.
Right. No, so this is the mentality. And even the lenders themselves are like, yeah, it sounds like a big deal, but it's really just people lying about their income. So that's for your listeners, like, that is the perspective in Canada. So I mean, I don't want to like make it out to be. I'm not saying it's like, you know, half of all mortgage originations,
right,
but
yeah,
it's a bigger issue than people realize.
Right. Okay. Okay. So let's now change gears to the challenging environment for banks. So banks make their money in a variety of ways. They got different lines of business. But you recently wrote to your clients about why there's a challenge for the EPS, the earnings per share for banks. And what is that challenge?
Sure. So there's a couple things that play into that. One is just that you're going to see originations. I think you're going to see mortgage credit growth continue to slow. It's already started to roll over kind of mid-year.
Right.
And I think that's a trend that's going to continue. I think these B20 rules, which are going to force this stress test, are going to take a lot of tailwind out of the market. And you'll see credit growth slow. But more importantly, we know that credit performance has been exceptional, right? People just aren't defaulting in any way. That's true across all sorts of consumer credit products, including credit cards.
Right.
One of the things I think is going to happen with B20 is you'll start to see that some of those serial refinancers who now have to stress test to get a much higher rate won't have the ability to roll that high interest credit card debt into their mortgage. And you'll start to see, I think, a normalization in the arrears rate there, which is not to say that you're going to see like, you know, a US style blowout in arrears. But at this point in the economic cycle, there's sort of a place where arrears should be in sort of a normal expansion. And we're way below that.
Right.
We're way below across virtually all credit products. And so it begs the question, like, why is that? Like, are things really fundamentally different? Or is there something else at play that's allowing people who otherwise might declare some sort of insolvency to stay afloat? One interesting observation from another insolvency trustee in the space. So Doug Hoyes, I don't know if you ever chat with him, he's a super knowledgeable, really nice guy.
Follow him on Twitter.
Right. So same business line as Scott. And he's got this great index where he actually charts the percentage of their clients, so the people coming in to file insolvency, the percentage of those people who also own a home.
Right.
It's very interesting.
Yes.
So in a normal environment, they find that it's normally kind of between 25 and 35%. So call it a third of their people are homeowners. Now, in the last couple of years, as prices have gone kind of parabolic, that number's plunged all the way to a low of 6%.
Wow, really? Yeah.
But here's what's very interesting is since the spring when prices started to flatline in Ontario, and we'll use that term generously, and if you're in the downtown core, they're up, but in a lot of other parts of Ontario, they're pretty weak.
Yeah.
And that little bit of flattening in house prices and that reduced ability to roll some of that credit, that number has kind of bounced off that bottom. And I think it hit 12% mm-hmm. in a recent reading. So it's like basically straight line down to 6%, house prices flat, and it spikes back up. And so when you think about that in the context of the banks, you've got sort of a challenging EPS environment in terms of having to start to recognize more. There's also IFRS 9, which we don't have to get into, the accounting rules. It forces the banks to recognize losses a little earlier. And so you boil all that down. And then the third thing that I'd say is if you look at the composition of business loan growth at the big banks, it's skewed so heavily to real estate industries.
Right.
Like it's incredible. So it's about 84% of the year-over-year growth, according to One Stats Canada series that I track. 84% of the loan growth at domestic banks in the business sector have been construction, finance or insurance, or real estate services, right, which collectively are all, they're not pure housing, but they're
related. Kind
of proxy, right? They're proxy industries for housing. And so if you're of the view that, we may be seeing the point where housing has a few more headwinds, then that's going to be challenging to see that longer. I mean, you see the charts at how construction loans have grown at the big banks and how real estate industry loans. I mean, it's incredible. So you're
like
talking
clockwork too.
Yeah, you're talking about almost 50% nominal loan growth over the last few years. I think over the last 4 years, I think it is.
And switching a little bit into the world of investing. If you take a look at the Canadian economy, one of the criticisms of the TSX as an index is that 75% of it is basically three sectors: energy, materials, and finance. Mm-hmm.
It's financial. Even worse if you look at the earnings breakdown.
And further to that, if you take a look at financials itself, which is a huge component mm-hmm. of the TSX, a lot of financials are now geared towards real estate because of the growth here. Right. So something to be cognizant of.
It's almost half. So you're right. So the financials are, and I'd have to get the exact numbers, but the financials are about a third of the market cap, I think. Yeah. But in terms of earnings, like the actual earnings of TSX companies, I think it's pushing half.
Yeah, I don't know what the exact number is, but a lot of those earnings have been more disproportionately growing or shifting over to residential construction, real estate, all that stuff. So, okay, let's now talk about, because we're coming up on the 45-minute mark, let's talk about Toronto versus Vancouver.
Sure.
So we saw in Vancouver there was a raft of regulations brought in designed to try and cool the market. Mm-hmm. There was a bit of a pause and then it kind of bounced back.
For the most part, it's a little more nuanced than that. But do you want to start with maybe just an overview of kind of what's happening in Vancouver
yes.
and Toronto? Okay, yeah. Let's start there. So you're right. It's if you look at Vancouver, they brought in some regulations 2016. And it took a lot of steam out of particularly the single family market. Mm-hmm. Now what we find today is, so first of all, one important note is when sales slumped in Vancouver, new listings fell through the floor,
right?
Which is really important to note because what it showed is that when the sales got weak, people just pulled their homes off the market. They refused to list. And it consequently, you didn't have this huge build in inventory.
Right.
And so the markets never really got crazy out of balance, even though sales had fallen significantly.
Okay.
Now, since then, I'll tell you that the single family market is still relatively weak and a lot weaker than I think people realize. If you look at, well, there's a chart in that deck that you've got there, but the detached house prices have been down for the last couple of months on a seasonally adjusted basis. And you can see that they fell in 2016. They kind of rebounded a bit, but they never really gained a ton of traction, right? I think you're looking at page 12 for you there, Preet, right? So they've basically yep. been flat since Q1 of this year mm-hmm. in Vancouver, which I think most people would be surprised at. All of the strength right now in Vancouver is in the condo market. And we're talking serious strength.
Right.
Now, part of that's an affordability issue that the locals...
They can't afford $10 million for a single
right,
detached.
Right, shocking, right? So you end up with just this kind of like funneling of demand into sure. one segment, which yeah. is it's also happening here in Toronto.
Yeah.
But that single family market is still relatively weak in Vancouver, and I think also so I've got some industry or got some areas in Vancouver that I track as kind of a proxy for the foreign bid.
Okay.
And you'll see. Let's see. You probably have that chart, but. Yeah, right there on page 14. So one of the things, if you look at like, for example, so your listeners can keep track of this. So if you look at like Vancouver West or West Vancouver, which are two separate neighborhoods, and you look at the detached market, there's quite a bit of evidence, albeit anecdotal, that was one part of the city that attracted a lot of foreign capital, Right. And the realtors there will generally tell you that. And what you see is
that, parents, they got a place in West Van.
Right. There you go.
Renting it out.
Yeah. So this is, like you see the sales trends way below peak levels, never recovered. Right. And if you look here in Toronto, by the way, if you were to look at, say, Richmond Hill and Markham detached, same sort of dynamic. So you could actually make the argument that the foreign demand has slowed in Canada. But in Vancouver, the detached market's never really come back. The condo market's gone just completely gangbusters. Mm-hmm. Very solid macroeconomic backdrop. So there are some legitimate underlying demand fundamentals at play. You look here in Toronto, it's actually a lot more interesting. I think Toronto's the most interesting market right now in the country. So you have highly segmented market in terms of condos versus detached or single family. And then this crazy divergence between like the 905 and the 416. So if you happen to own a home and you're like core Toronto, especially the condo market, like this little mini correction in early 2017, you didn't notice that at all, mm-hmm. right? And for you, it's probably in the rearview mirror because the condo market, by and large, it's not back to like boom times like it was, but it's still very, very firm in the 416. Single family in the 416, let's call it balanced. Okay. So prices are off, maybe call it flat to maybe off 5% from peak, but generally trending in the right direction. But you get outside of the 416, you get into the 905 and you get into the single family space. Serious issues. And when I say serious issues, so we track some same unit sales. So for example, homes that sold in March or April that have since sold again this mm-hmm. year. And a lot of them, we're talking single family, 905, a lot of those homes are trading hands for 20% less or more than what they traded for in the spring.
Really?
So actual transactions, right? So we're not talking about like average price or anything right. weird like that where there's like compositional shifts or games played with the numbers. I'm talking about this exact home sold this spring. It just sold again in November or December. It's sold for 20 or 25% less, like major declines.
Now, do you have any insight as to why those houses sold in such a short period of time? Like, why were there two transactions in the same
that's
year?
That's a good question. In some cases, some of it is deals that went firm, fell through.
Okay.
House is relisted, sells again. In some cases, it takes 10 months for it to sell again.
Right.
And it sells the next price they get. 8 months or 10 months later, whatever, is 25% less than the contract they had.
Right.
So we're talking major declines, which is, it's funny. On the last podcast we did, we talked about this whole idea of like leverage can be dangerous when you're late in the cycle. And there's a great example. Like, you feel bad for those people that bought in April in some of these areas in the 905.
Do I feel bad for them?
I do. Yeah, it's tough. Like it's just tough. Like, this is they were blindsided by some regulation. You and I understand that psychology is a powerful thing. And people, when you get into these strong upwards, movements in any asset price, people just do crazy things.
You're right. I do feel
bad. It's hard. Right. So that's a game changer. If you plunk down $2 million on a home in the, the 905 hinterlands, like you could be down, like that could be your life savings gone already. Now, look, whatever, it's going to come back eventually, but I think I'll tell you, I think that there's more pain to come for that, mm-hmm. that 905.
There was a couple of stories I saw local media about, I think it was in the first quarter of the year when house prices were really spiking. And then there was a drop off and people were walking away from the deals that they had committed to. So do you have any insights into that? Like how pervasive was that? Was it a handful of stories that got media attention?
No, it was a thing. Yeah. It was a real thing. I had, it was definitely happening. I spoke with lawyers that were talking about, just how much of their business had become that exact dynamic. So it was a real thing. A lot of that, and I would say that a lot of the turmoil we saw in Toronto over the summer was a lot of that working its way through the system. Because what we found was people had, back in the spring, you couldn't, in a normal market, you would try to sell your house and then you go buy another one, or you would buy a house with the condition that you sell yours, right?
Right.
But as we all know, the market got so hot that people are like, oh, that's fine. I'll buy this one. I'll commit to buying this one and then I'll list mine for sale. And it would no problem. It'll sell by tomorrow at this time, right? Which is what was happening.
Yeah.
And instead, people went in, they went firm on these houses in, April, and thinking that they would list And have no problem selling. And all of a sudden the market stopped on a dime.
Right.
And so now you're stuck with, you own a house, you own a mortgage, and you're legally contracted to close on this one over here.
Right.
So for that reason, you know, we knew there'd be all sorts of stress working the way through the system, all sorts of people that were carrying two mortgages and all sorts of, you know, funny. And you saw that through the summer where there's a lot of really panicked selling.
Right.
You know, that I think some of the worst of that's worked its way through the system. But what concerns me, and kind of going back to Vancouver, because I think a lot of people are of the view that Toronto will see this kind of like Vancouver style rebound.
Right.
I'm not sure that's the case. So I kind of laid out what happened in Vancouver when sales fell, which is that new listings fell sharply. That has not been the case in Toronto. And so, for example, last month, the new listings here in Toronto are up, I'd have to look at exactly, but call it 30% year over year, like big jumps,
right.
Record high in terms of new listings here in Toronto. So until that stops, then you're going to continue to see this big build in inventory. So like homes for sale in Toronto right now is more than double what was for sale last year at this time. And when you get out into some of those hard hit areas in the 905, it's triple or in some cases up 4X. Right. It's like big, big increases. Right. So I don't see it yet. And even though we've seen an increase in sales off the lows, some of that's in part due to people trying to front run these B20 rules, like buy now before I get squeezed out in January.
Right.
Right. So I don't know that this, like the real strong uptick in sales in the last couple of months is going to be an actual durable uptick, but I'll tell you that I don't really care. For me, the more important metric, and I've said this for a while now, is the flow of new listings. If that continues at the current pace, then there's a lot more downside still in Toronto.
Okay. Cause I was going to ask you, you know, and I have to say myself, you know, for years I've been thinking that Toronto house prices are just nuts. When I look at the price to rent ratios, mm-hmm. What do you think is going to be the ultimate conclusion here? Is it that, yeah, Toronto is a world-class city and this is just what it's going to be? Is there a likelihood of a correction? And maybe remind people of how severe a correction could happen. I'm not saying that it's going to, but what has happened in the past?
Well, all you have to do is ask the people in the 905 that bought in March or April. Right? Okay. They'll tell you what a correction feels like, right? I'm conflicted on this one. I think that if you have a view on a market, you should be able to articulate the other side.
Right.
And articulate it intelligently. So I think there's a lot of people out there who, they have a lot of, they're conflicted. And so you hear some people that are either bullish or bearish on Toronto. And in a lot of cases, they're talking their own book. Right. Mm-hmm. But if you kind of strip that out and you look at some more intelligent people that are commenting on this, I think there's something to be said. Or let me rephrase that. I don't discount completely this possibility that Toronto, and when I say Toronto, I'm talking the core. So 416 yeah. core prime area
right.
is trending towards pricing that's more international.
Right.
I'm not saying that's likely, but I'm saying that I don't discount that completely.
Got okay? it.
If that's the case, then I think what you could see in the next cycle, and let's just revert back for a minute. We do know that real estate is cyclical.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's been a long time since we've seen a true cycle outside of these kind of, you know, isolated issues in certain parts of the country. So we will see another cycle. When that cycle plays out, it's going to be, I think there's a lot of evidence that the next cycle will be a bad one. For a lot of the, you know, high household indebtedness, extremely low rates with really not a lot of room to go to cushion any downside. But if you think about what that could look like, if you look at the U.S. as an example or any international downturn, if you study any international downturn, what you find is that the core areas tend to fall less and recover quicker.
Right.
Where you run into a lot of problems and where you see these like really catastrophic house price declines is when you get way outside of the core into some of these suburbs that have built up and where you had this like huge, you know, drive until you qualify phenomenon.
Right.
Right. And which is totally symptomatic of these, you know, literally if you go back and you Google drive until you qualify 2005, you'll see all sorts of articles around like Las Vegas and like, right. And this is a phenomenon. This was a thing back then too. Right. And
right.
they built up these cities way outside of the core. And when the correction came, those are the areas that got hammered. Right. And they got, and they, and in many cases, they have not yet recovered to their peak. So for me, I would say that the downtown core in Toronto and in Vancouver is more likely to hold its value relative to some of those areas. Like I would be really concerned about putting 5% down. You know, it's different if I lived there and I worked there, but if I was working downtown Toronto and commuting and buying, you know, an hour away, to me, that's a really dangerous trade, because if the market turns on you, it's going to turn badly in those suburbs.
Any insights into the rental market in Toronto?
Yeah, so it's still really tight. That is one of the supporting factors behind this tight resale market, is that the rental market is also quite tight. I think that 2018 is going to be a year where we see that change.
In what way?
Well, there's two dynamics at play. One is that we now have some Airbnb restrictions that are going to come in mid-year.
Oh, right. Yes.
Right. And they've got that in Vancouver as well. So you will see, I believe, a migration of some of these kind of secondary units like condos that were in the Airbnb pool move back into the long-term rental pool. Mm-hmm. So that's one. I think the bigger thing is you've got a pile of new construction of purpose-built rentals. I mean, here, look at this, like page 15. You probably have it in front of you there. And I know, sorry, this doesn't help your listeners at all, but just you can describe it.
They have to pay if they want this research.
But I'll tell you, if you describe this chart for rental apartment units under construction in British Columbia, and which includes obviously includes Vancouver.
It's a hockey stick.
It's a total hockey stick, right? It's basically flat around like 2,000 units going back all the way to 1990. There's like a little bit of a spike in kind of the mid-2000s up to like 4,000. And then it goes straight up, like literally a straight line, 90-degree angle up to 12,000 units in the last couple of years. Right. And in Ontario, it's not quite as extreme, but we're back up to all-time highs. And it's funny because like people are always saying to me like, oh, there's just, we haven't built any purpose-built rentals in 30 years. And that's just not true. We've got a lot in the pipeline.
Right.
Right. It's back up to all-time. Now that's not accounting for population. So if you normalize that for the actual population, it's obviously it's less than the previous peak, but it's up a lot.
Right.
And if you look at the timeline to construction on these, it's generally around 17 to 18 months. Which is quite a bit less than it is for condos. So you look at when these were started and you kind of tack 18 months onto that, and you should start to see a big uptick in completions in 2018, right? A purpose-built rental. So I think you should see that ease a bit. I think it's going to be a tough year for landlords. If you have listeners that own, for example, a condo and it's, you know, maybe cash flow neutral or a little bit cash flow negative, you really have to be careful, because one of the trends that we're seeing a lot of is these small landlords are going back to their bank at renewal to get their mortgage, and mortgage rates are going up. They're going up. They're really taking advantage of a lot of these small time.
And the landlords aren't allowed to increase rent anymore like they used to.
Correct. So you've got a dynamic here where you've got a cap on the rents you can charge.
Was it 1.5% per year?
It's the lesser of 1.5% or no, inflation, CPI inflation, or 1.5%, I believe is.
Okay. In any case, there's now a cap on the rent increase.
And it's pretty, it's, you know, when you compare it to how much your maintenance fees are going up, I mean, it's eating into your bottom line.
Right.
Right. So you've got that working against you. You've got mortgage rates that are disproportionately going up for investors. And you got to be mindful of that. We've heard a few horror stories of people that were caught, you know, thought they were going to go back and renew at 3.5% and they get quoted at 5.5% and it blows out their cash flow and they have to sell. Right. I've heard a few of those. That's fairly recent. So, you know, I think it's going to be a bit, and then if you get a bit of softening in that market, I think it'll be an interesting, well, interesting is the wrong word. It'll be a less than ideal year for some for people who are highly levered in the landlord space.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Ben. I think we're going to leave it there. We're just ticking past the 1 hour mark on this interview. Yeah, I know. And we've got more that we'll cover. Actually, you know what? I'll let you determine if there's anything else that you want to get off your chest on this edition of your visit to the podcast, or if you want to save it for your next visit.
Oh, man. Let's see. Well, one of the things I guess I would say to your listeners is, first of all, be ready for some really nasty headlines in late Q1, early Q2 of 2018, because if you look at pricing in Toronto, I'm talking about Toronto specific right now, you look at the pricing in Toronto, it peaked, you had this parabolic rise in kind of first quarter last year from January to March, where it went up, literally went up like 20% in 3 months. And then came down quite sharply. If you move that forward and you look at what's going to happen in kind of March, April this year, we butt up against these really nasty year-over-year comparisons. And so you're probably going to see average resale prices down 15 or 20%.
Right. So you're talking about March, April of 2018.
2018.
Yeah.
Correct. And part of that is due to just compositional shift. Yeah. The single family market's getting hit really hard. So that kind of pulls down the average. But from a psychological perspective, it's going to make some nasty headlines.
Oh, right. Sure,
so,
yeah.
So when you see newspapers quoting, so just be mindful that is coming. It is going to be reflective in part of just a shift in composition, but part of it's just that prices are actually going to be off quite a bit.
So that could really, really change sentiment a little bit because you've got that headline number, potentially a first quarter rate hike. Put those two together and people are saying, aha, this correction we've been waiting for, now's the time. And then sentiment can turn on a dime. We don't know what it ultimately will take for that to change, but it could change, turn on a dime, right?
Yeah, I think, it's going to be a shock, I think, for some people.
Yeah.
So, you know, be ready for that. I think, like I said, if I was looking at the 905, I still think there's more downside there. I know it's already been pretty hard hit, but when I look at what's coming online still for units under construction in that single family space, still at almost 30-year highs. There's a lot of inventory still to come on online there. So I don't think the worst is behind us there. The core of the downtown actually looks all right. The active inventory and kind of the flow of new listings has been okay. So I'm a little less concerned about that. The other area that has me a bit concerned going into 2018 is the new construction market. So there'd be a bit of a nasty surprise for some people who bought a pre-construction condo or a single family home in kind of 2017 or before that go to close on it in 2018.
Right.
Because they may not realize that they now have to qualify under these new B20 rules, right? Which is going to be a bit of a shock. If you think that the amount that you're qualifying for has just been cut by about 20%, the maximum amount, if you were butting up against that, you may not qualify for the mortgage to close. Right, which is another way of saying that I think we're going to see a very active assignment market in Ontario in 2018.
Right. And what's assignment mean?
Yeah, just for your listeners. So assignment is when you buy a new unbuilt unit to be delivered at a later date. In some cases, you have the ability to resell that contract to someone else. So you're not actually selling the property itself. You're selling the contract to close on that property.
Right. Yeah.
Right? And you'll probably see a very active assignment market. Now, where it potentially becomes problematic, and this is probably a story more for like 2019 or 2020, is getting back to some of these crazy condo investors. These new condos are being bought at a significant premium to resale market. Like in some cases, we're talking at, $200 a square foot more than resale.
Really?
Which is insane. I know. That's my reaction exactly. What are you people thinking? If you go back, like, so a great guy to talk to is David Fleming. You should have him on your podcast.
He's
a great guy.
Should. Yeah.
So
I get his flyers all the time.
Oh, he's awesome. I love the guy. So he's one realtor who is a, and there's a number of them. Don't get me wrong, but there's also some people in the industry that aren't always, straight with the facts.
What?
David Fleming's one of those guys.
Salespeople?
No. I know. Crazy. But he always made the point that if you go back far enough, and by far enough, I mean like 7-8 years before this crazy boom. If you were a developer and you wanted to sell a condo, typically you'd have to price it below the resale market to attract investors. And your margin there was that you're buying it at a discount. And as it completes, it aligns with resale and there's your profit. And he has this great analogy, David does. And he made this video a couple of years ago where he's like, he's got like a full cake, like nicely iced and looks awesome. He's like, okay, you can buy this brand, like fully made iced cake. It's beautiful. You can eat it right now, $5. Or over here, I'll sell you a box of cake mix for $10. And you have to go home and like make it yourself and everything. He's like, which one should you buy? Right? Like what right? So shouldn't it be that the cake mix that isn't yet made should be less than the cake that's already made? And he's making the point that that's normally how it is in the condo market. But in the last few years, it switched because there was so much demand for new inventory from investors and speculators.
Right.
And so now just to tie that all together, these people who are going to have problems financing some of them under the new B20, it's compounded if they paid well above market price.
Yeah.
Because now they not only have financing issues, they have appraisal issues as well.
Oh, boy.
Right? Right. So you see the issue, right? So people just need to be mindful of that. If you're listening and you have a pre-construction condo that you still have to finance, you may want to go talk to your lender and get an appraisal on that and maybe look at potentially what you qualify for and whether you should assign it.
That's good advice. And I will ask you one last thing. For people who are thinking about becoming a first-time home buyer right now, what's your general advice to them? What should they factor in? I'm not going to ask you to say, there's going to be a market correction in June or anything like that. But yeah. What's your general advice to people who are like, no, I want to be a homeowner. Everyone tells me I should. I'm gearing up to, I'm saving up my down payment. What's your general advice to them?
Yeah, look, I would say that so make sure you love the place. Make sure you're okay being there for 5 or 10 years because the last thing you want is for you to buy into a place, prices fall, your labor mobility is gone, you can't move to pursue other career options. That could very much be a reality for some of the people that bought in Q1 of this year.
Right.
So make sure that you're willing to stay there for five. If you're not going to be there for at least 5 years, don't do it.
Right.
I would say try to get the 20% down, give yourself a bit of a buffer, make sure that you've tested your finance as well. I mean, these new stress tests will kind of do that for you.
Yeah.
But make sure you're comfortable with that. If you have to go to a private lender to finance any part of it, you really shouldn't be buying. You have no business buying if that's who you have to go to. And just be mindful that, yeah, rates are probably going to go up a bit more before they stabilize. Make sure you've got that budgeted in and be prepared to ride it out if it does go down.
Excellent. Wonderful advice as always. A very insightful interview as always. Ben, thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
And as you know, every guest gets a commercial at the end to promote whatever they want. So the floor is yours. If you have anything, your Twitter handle, a website, if people want to inquire about paying for your research, where are they to go?
Yeah, no, I can't. Again, I'm really limited in who I can put on my distribution, so I won't put a plug in for any of my research.
You don't sell it?
It's not to individuals. It's institutional.
Institutional, right?
Yeah.
I've got some institutional listeners. So.
Oh yeah. Well, there you go. If you're an institutional listener, you can info@northcove.net.
And otherwise, if you're not, don't bug them.
Always happy to chat with people, especially if you're in the industry and you just want to kind of chew the fat a bit. I'm always happy to.
Yeah, connect. And Twitter handle.
@BenRabidoo. It is a private account. Yep. So, I don't always get around to activating all the followers.
Right.
I'm not really a publicity guy. I'm quite happy to kind of.
So you're not going to start your own podcast because there'd be a huge demand for it.
Well, it's tough to do something. It's time consuming. When you're trying to.
Yeah. You don't make any money from it. Like I don't. I mean, it's really a waste of my time.
Well, I'm not so much that, but I cannibalize my own business, but it'd be fun. But you know what? I'll keep coming up
on this one.
And I give you good ideas for guys like David Fleming, Scott Terrio. Those guys are good dudes to talk to.
Keep it coming. My listeners appreciate it. All right. So that's it for this week. Again, Ben, thank you so much for coming on the show. And to all the listeners, we will see you again next time, whenever that may be. I know it's been like months since the last one before Scott, and then it's been like 4 days between that and this one. But you know me, I just can't be bothered. So, anyways, thanks for tuning in. We'll talk to you next time.